Now, if you don't know Father Pavone, there's a comprehensive biography in the booklet, which I'll let you read, although for some reason he's referred to as Dr. Pavone, if you had a chance to take a look at it. So maybe there's something about your background that we don't know you're here yet, but if someone's not feeling well, you can see Father Pavone or Dr. Pavone afterwards. But rather than recapping his background, which is extensive and his organizational reach is tremendous, I'll let you read that. I'd rather spend my introduction time telling you what a special man and a special priest he is. First and foremost, he is a defender of life at all levels, not just supporting and including the unborn, but the infirmed and the elderly as well. He ministers to women who have had abortions and to families facing end-of-life decisions. And, of course, we all know that we're in a ferocious battle. It's a ferocious battle that we are fighting here. And Father Pavone, I like to think of him as our fearless field marshal, because every group needs a leader. He works tirelessly. He travels hard. I don't know how many frequent flyer miles you must have, but it's a lot. We could all take a vacation probably on yours. And he goes wherever the fight takes him. He is not intimidated by the social and political elites whose moral code is political correctness. He is not afraid to engage in the political process when it furthers the cause. Of course, his job would be so much easier if the liberal anti-life people in this country felt as passionately about life, the right to life, as they do about the right to negotiate labor agreements. Wouldn't that be nice? His detractors call him a meddlesome priest, but it is only fitting that our field marshal be a priest, because really, the underlying sin of the anti-life people is truly a rejection of God and His will. And so it is, his priesthood is an advantage as our field marshal here. It is my privilege to give you the true defender of the faith and of our U.S. Constitution, Father Frank Pavone.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be back in Ohio, great to be back in Cleveland, and let me say what a great job, echoing what so many others have said, what a great job Cleveland Right to Life does, and Ohio Right to Life. You know, I do travel nonstop. My suitcase is never unpacked. I hit at least four states a week. I see what the pro-life groups are doing on the state level and on the local level, and you really, really are at the top of the list. You're doing a fantastic job here, so congratulations for that. We have a lot of work to do together, and we look forward to the kind of collaboration that we have had over the years between your efforts and those of Priests for Life, and that we will have in the months and years to come, especially as we get ready for another presidential election cycle. Now, I have a few preliminary things to tell you before I share with you the core of my message tonight. I almost wasn't here today for a reason which, if it had taken me away from this gathering, would have been a good reason, something that is still unfolding. Some of you may have followed through our website and emails or through some of the media that it has engendered the case of this baby in Canada by the name of Baby Joseph. Here we have a situation of a child who is suffering from a neurological disease, needs help to breathe, and this 14-month-old baby, by standard medical practice, should have had a tracheotomy months ago, and instead is still on a breathing tube, and despite the insistence and the wishes of this child's parents to stabilize his breathing with a procedure that is relatively simple and standard, the hospital in which this child is in Canada refuses to do it. Not because it isn't medically helpful. They admit that it's medically helpful and can extend this child's life, even though the underlying disease may not be able to be cured. The problem simply is this, that the medical board is now making more than medical judgments. It's making value judgments. Instead of saying this or that treatment is worthless, which is a perfectly valid thing to say if it's true, they're saying this life is worthless. And this is the line that we insist be held, that you don't cross over. We want our medical professionals to be the best medical professionals they can be. But whether it's in Canada or in the United States or any other nation of the world, we want medical professionals to make medical judgments, not value judgments on how much a life is worth. There are such things as worthless treatments. There's no such thing as a worthless life. And so, we have said to the family and to the hospital that we will find a facility here in the United States of America that will take this child and will do this procedure. And we have been negotiating for weeks with various medical facilities around the country. Sometimes we have gotten very, very close to the point where they would agree to take this child. We have an air ambulance standing by, ready to get this baby to the hospital here in the States that would do this simple procedure for him. And we have gotten very, very close a number of times. This morning, before leaving my office to go to the airport to come here, I get a flurry of phone calls and emails saying, Father Frank, you might have to go to Canada today. Because it looks like we are this close to getting the deal finally made. I didn't get on the air ambulance today. I ended up here because the negotiations are still proceeding. But there are, I'm happy to say, two facilities now here in the States that are ready and willing to take this child. So, it could be in the next hours, it could be in the next days that we will do this. And it will be a tremendous statement for the value of life. So pray for baby Joseph, pray for his family, and pray that somehow a little bit at least of this message gets out. None of us is saying that we have to prolong life forever on this earth. We know the inevitability of death. We know the reality of life eternal. None of us is saying that you have to have every conceivable procedure and treatment and machine. We're not saying that. We've never said that. We never will say that. But what we are saying is that the danger today is not that we will be hooked up to all kinds of machines that we don't want or get all kinds of interventions that we would rather not have. The danger today is that we're not going to get the things we do want and the treatment that we do need. And we need to speak up together and are speaking up together as a Right to Life community to say that it is the person, it is the human person, the human patient, born or unborn, who is the primary consideration in all of this. Not economics and not some kind of moral judgment of a medical community that assigns some lives more value than others. That's my first preliminary point. Now, secondly, it was already mentioned, and Teresa Tomeo is here, and Janet Morana, our executive director, is up in New York tonight, and the two of them together with Astrid Bennett Gutierrez, a young woman from Los Angeles who runs the Los Angeles Pregnancy Services, a pregnancy service facility in the midst of, within a 1-mile radius about 7 abortion facilities serving those babies and their parents there in L.A. These three women have started this new television series, The Catholic View for Women. And I was with them in the taping of this down at EWTN back in December. And I was, it was a little bit of a role reversal. I wasn't on the set. I wasn't in front of the camera. I wouldn't have been able to get a word in edgewise if I were. Now let me tell you something about it. First of all, this is a great step forward. It's an alternative to The View. It's an alternative where, you know, you're going to have women talking about things that actually make sense. You like that, huh? Yeah. That actually are on the minds and hearts of countless people across our country who often feel that they're not represented in what they're watching on the TV screen. It's going to be aired initially, it was just on an hour ago, aired initially each month on EWTN, and then hopefully as time goes on, with the support of the viewers, even more frequently. TheCatholicViewForWomen.com. Check it out when you have a chance. And you can give some input into the kind of things that you'd like to see them discuss. But I do want to share one experience when I was with them while they were taping this program in December. Janet told me, you know, Father, you know, we're scheduled to start the taping at, you know, 9 o'clock, but, you know, you don't have to be there exactly at 9 o'clock. And this was very unusual because she knows how I am with time and precision and punctuality. She said, no, we're going to do our makeup first. So I figured, okay, well, how long can that take, you know? So I said, all right, but I won't rush. I'll come down, you know, 9:15, 9:30. So I come down about 9:20 or so. And I go into this room outside of the studio. And there are two women there doing the makeup. And I go into the room and my jaw drops and I look again. And there's this table there, big table, with all sorts of things on it that I couldn't identify. Liquids and creams and instruments. And I said, this is not makeup. This is a surgical facility here. What are you doing? It was very, very interesting as I sat there for almost an hour and observed, you know, concoctions and things and procedures that I never imagined were possible. But anyway, they look great. And that's part of the message, too. There's nothing unchristian about presenting yourself in a beautiful way. And this is something that we rediscover. We talk about the goodness of creation, the beauty of life, and the theology of the body. Many, many great things coming across in this Catholic View for Women. All right, brothers and sisters, here's what I want to say to you tonight, very, very simply. The days of legal abortion in this country are numbered. This organization, Cleveland Right to Life, all the different works that you are all involved in conjunction with other organizations, we're all doing what we're doing, not simply because we want to reduce the numbers of abortions, not simply because we want to bear witness against abortion, and not simply because we want to try to end abortion. We're involved in this for one reason, and it's a goal which each and every day we need to recommit ourselves to and grasp once again. We are here for the sole purpose of putting an end to abortion. That's what this is. And when we sit and think about it and say, well, of course, this is obvious. It's obvious to us. It's not obvious to even people who are sympathetic to us out there in the broader public, even in the broader church. I had a priest ask me not all that long ago, well, you know, is it really possible to end abortion? And I said, well, Father, you know, I mean, we know that until the end of time, people will sin and people will lie and people will steal and people will kill. But was it impossible to end the institution of slavery in this nation. This is an industry. This is an institution. This is a monster. Not only is it possible to end it, it is something we are commanded to do. And it is something that we have every power and every tool to do. We must have that confidence. And brothers and sisters, this is at the essence of leadership, because we're all leaders in one way or another in this movement. In the essence of leadership, people look to you and they want to see someone who's convinced that we can bring this evil to an end. Let's state it clearly and let's inspire that hope in the people that work with us and the people to whom we speak. I was recently with, in his last days here on earth, one of those who, as he described it, uncaged the abortion monster in the United States. You all know that Dr. Bernard Nathanson passed away only a couple of weeks ago, on February 21st. Now, Dr. Nathanson was one of the founders of the abortion rights movement. NARAL, which today is called NARAL Pro-Choice America, has gone through several name changes. At that time, it was the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. The prime mover, if you will, of the change in the laws in this country, and that was their goal, to wipe away every abortion-related law in the country and make a free and open path to abortion on demand. When they got together and strategized and plotted and schemed how to do this in the mid-60s, it seemed like a preposterous goal. And nevertheless, they did this. Dr. Nathanson, Larry Lader, Betty Friedan, and a number of other people, they did this. And Dr. Nathanson eventually ran the largest abortion clinic in the world, there in New York City. He himself, between the abortions he did with his own hands, the medical students whom he supervised, and the abortions that took place in the clinic he ran, which did the abortions 364 days a year, from early morning until late at night, guess what day was the only day of the year they didn't do abortions? Christmas Day. But it wasn't because of any religious conviction on the part of those who ran the clinic. If they had had patients coming, they would have done them on Christmas. They didn't do them because people didn't want to get abortions on Christmas. Interesting psychological study there somewhere, someday. But he did between those three sources, he was responsible for some 75,000 abortions. Now, this man was an atheist. Eventually, something began happening within him. Aside from the fact, and it's a clear fact that he spoke about often, that doing these abortions and overseeing these abortions destroys not only the child, not only the mom and dad and the family, it destroys the personality of the abortionist. You can't dehumanize the child that you're killing without dehumanizing yourself. He was exhausted by this. He saw his life beginning to disintegrate and the lives of his colleagues. But it wasn't the only reason that eventually he became weary of abortion. The science was awakening his conscience. He came to know the unborn child face to face. Ultrasound technology was developing. And as soon as we develop ultrasound technology, we also develop fetal therapy. Because if you can see, you can diagnose. If you can diagnose, you can begin to find ways to treat. The unborn child was clearly becoming medical science's newest patient. And you can find that exact phrase now in various medical textbooks on obstetrics. Dr. Nathanson began wondering how it was that on one floor of the same building they could be destroying these children, and on the next floor down taking the very same babies of the very same age and size and working to heal and save them. The contradiction was untenable after a while, and he began to raise questions about the advisability of abortion. Eventually, he got to the point, 1979, he couldn't do any abortions anymore because he was convinced it was wrong. Now notice he was still an atheist. What broke the shell of his atheism eventually was the love of people like you. The way he was treated by the pro-life movement. The love of people like us. Because when we say the dignity of every human life, we mean every, including the abortionists. We mean every. And if we mean every, we have to convey that meaning. They have to feel it. They have to see it. They have to know it. They have to be on the receiving end of our love. They have to be on the receiving end of our truth, and it is out of love that we convey that truth. But they have to be on the receiving end of the truth spoken by people that they are utterly convinced care about them. And he started to experience that. In 1994, by that time he was giving pro-life talks all around the country, and he was speaking at a Human Life International conference in Irvine, California. Now at that time I had already started my full-time work with Priests for Life. And at that particular conference that year, I was asked to moderate the session that Dr. Nathanson was presenting at. So I introduced him. It was a big room, bigger than this, filled with people. Introduced him. He started his talk. He changed the topic of the talk at the last minute. To this day, the audio cassette that has that talk has a different title than what he actually spoke about. He was supposed to speak about RU486 and chemical abortion. He got up to the podium and he said, "Today, I'm going to wing it. I'm not using any notes or slides. I'm going to talk about my spiritual journey." And we were like, whoa, what is this going to be? And he started talking. Now, notice what he said. Not his medical journey, not even his intellectual journey, his spiritual journey. Well, he went on in that talk for over an hour, speaking about how he was discovering the truth. The truth being not only that which we come to know through the science that we practice, but the full truth about the meaning of existence and of life eternal. At the end of that talk, he was saying that it was untenable to him anymore to think that those who through the centuries had held forth to the human family the hope of eternal life as outlined in the Gospels, that all of these people who have given their lives for Christ and for the faith could have all been deceived. He said, "No, this to me is no longer tenable." And then he said, "I stand before you today on the brink of conversion." And the room exploded. We've all seen standing ovations. That day, it was a leaping ovation. I don't know how many of you know Dr. Alice von Hildebrand. You've seen her on EWTN. She was all the way in the back of the room. I'm sitting there up on the table. And I see her almost touch the ceiling. She went, woof, she went right up. And the whole room exploded. "I stand before you today on the brink of conversion." And that was just about the end of his speech. And he said, almost his voice cracking at the end, he said, I just ask you to pray for me. And I hope God can forgive me. Well, the whole room broke out into spontaneous prayer. And then before he left the room, I said, "Well, Dr. Nathanson, Mother Teresa, in ministering to the poor of Calcutta, often had non-believers say to her, this Jesus that you speak about, this God, is he like you?" And Mother Teresa would respond, "No, but I try to be like him." And I said to him, "We, the pro-life people that you say are so kind and so forgiving, it's just because we're trying to be like God, who has
has already forgiven you. Just a few days before he died, I visited with him in his apartment in Manhattan. He was only able to speak in a whisper. The first thing he said to me when I came in the room, "How goes the crusade?" And in the course of our conversation, I had to get up real close to him because I could hardly hear him. And he whispered encouragement to us, to all of you, to all of the movement. But I reminded him about that exchange. I reminded him about that workshop. I reminded him about that assurance that God indeed had forgiven him. There's a lot to learn from this man. Not only because it's a fascinating story of the relation between faith and reason, of the relationship between religion and science, a fascinating story about the trajectory that those who seek truth wherever it might lead them follow. But it's a significant story because of the message I want to emphasize with you tonight. That the days of abortion in this country are numbered. Because the journey of someone like Dr. Nathanson, who built the abortion industry, gives us a key to understand the journey of our entire society. It is, first of all, brothers and sisters, that healing is at the key to victory. This was a man who was suffering. See, usually, you know, people tend to think, especially when they first get into the movement, they look at the enemy. They look at these powerful organizations, these monumental movements that have money in their bank accounts that we don't even know how to count. And you know, billions of dollars being pumped into the pro-abortion efforts, and they see these people who have all kinds of political friends in high places, and they get all the media, and they look powerful. They look powerful. They're wounded. They're suffering. One of the ladies that I assisted in the early 90s to come out of the abortion movement ran six legal abortion clinics, presented herself as a doctor, never spent a day in medical school, told me how she never sterilized the instruments because they just wanted to do more and more abortions. But then one of the most memorable things she said to me while we were having a hamburger in Birmingham, Alabama, she said, "You know, Father, when I decided I had to come out of the abortion movement, the first people I went to were the protesters in front of my clinic." And I said, "Okay, why did you go to them? You have any friends you could go to?" She said, "I went to them because I knew that they knew my pain." Notice and remember those words. I knew that they knew my pain. Do we know the pain of our adversaries in this colossal struggle? Are we aware, and do we let them know we are aware, that they're not fooling us? When they come across so confident about what they're doing, so sure of themselves. They want the world to think that they are absolutely convinced every morning when they wake up that one of the most important things they're going to do is preserve a woman's right to choose. They think that the public thinks that they really believe what they're saying and that it makes them happy. It doesn't make them happy. They're conflicted, confused, and suffering. Now, Dr. Nathanson was that. And it was people who were able to come to him with the soothing oil of healing from the genuine concern that they had for him.
Now, we don't have the opportunity every day to sit down with the owner of 6 abortion clinics or someone like Dr. Nathanson. There's other ways that we do this. In the course of our movement, in every aspect of our movement, even the legislative and the political, all the aspects of it, to recommit ourselves to understanding that putting a megaphone behind the message of healing, behind the invitation to healing, is going to strengthen every aspect of the movement. Now, why is that the case? There are many reasons. Let me just tell you one of them briefly. The reason why, although most of the American people oppose most of the abortions that occur and most of the reasons for which they occur, it nevertheless still occurs, is not because they want it to still occur. It's not because they're in favor of it. It's not even because they don't want to do something about it. Here's the problem. So many of our fellow worshipers in our churches, or family, friends, co-workers, don't want to get involved in the efforts that you and I are involved in. Because they think that once they do, and if they do, they become an enemy of those who have had abortions. Follow what I'm saying? There's a sister, there's a daughter, there's an aunt, there's a cousin, there's a friend that they know had an abortion. The question in their mind is not, oh, is that a good thing that group is doing over there where they're educating about pro-life? Or is that a good thing those other people are doing when they want me to come and protest at that abortion clinic? Or is that a good thing that those people are doing when they want me to help elect a pro-life candidate? They're not necessarily doubting that those are good things to do. They're afraid that if they start doing them, they become an enemy of those people they love. And that's the psychology we need to understand, and we need to show the way we conduct ourselves and convey our message to show that, wait a second, we who reject abortion don't reject those who have abortions. By issuing the call to healing, the invitation to come to us for the healing, we're helping them to overcome that false dichotomy between advocating for the right to life and embracing with love and compassion those even who have destroyed life. When we can show that the both go together, when we can show that what we're trying to do to our culture is not point fingers of condemnation but extend hands of mercy, talk about recruiting to the pro-life cause, goes through the roof. We're overcoming a key obstacle. When we do seminars for the clergy in preaching about abortion, we make it clear that the first two things we need to say, whether we dwell on them long or short, in the beginning of a pro-life homily, are, number one, there are alternatives to abortion. Come to us for help. And number two, there is healing and forgiveness. The doors of the church are open. The more we can echo this call for healing, the more we will be strengthening everything that the movement does. We'll be taking away a key objection of our fellow citizens who are not closed to our message, but just somewhat uncomfortable with what that message is going to do to them. One of the ways that we echo this call for healing is through the work of the Silent No More Awareness campaign, the campaign which, in our nation and around the world, is taking the testimonies of those who've had abortions. The women, the men, the fathers who have participated. You know, a man cannot have the procedure of abortion done to his body, but he can commit the sin of abortion in his soul by choosing it, advocating it, pushing it, insisting on it. He chooses abortion. He commits the sin. And these men suffer so many of the same symptoms of post-abortion grief as the mothers do. And they too are coming forward and sharing that grief, sharing the healing. We can incorporate their voices. Two of the most powerful voices in the cause of ending abortion are the voices of the people like Dr. Nathanson and hundreds of others who have come and are coming out of the abortion movement, and the voices of the women and the men.
who have gone down that dead-end road, ignored the signs that said it's a dead-end, and then turned around learning by personal experience that it's a dead-end, and now they have become the signs. The other side says, listen to the voices of women. They've been saying that for decades. Now what do they say? We've put them in a dilemma. What are they going to say? Listen to the voices of women, but not those women that say something bad about abortion? You know? They tried to counteract this campaign. You've seen these women march at the front of the March for Life in Washington and of the Walk for Life in San Francisco and at rallies and marches all around the country. They go in front of the abortion facilities. They go into legislative assemblies. They're available to testify when particular laws are being passed that their own personal testimony can give some support to. And they make themselves available in churches, in pulpits, radio and TV programs, on the internet. And when they do this, they put the other side in a terrible dilemma. The other side has tried to counteract this in some way. You know, they have a campaign, Planned Parenthood had a little campaign for a while. I'm not sorry. And it didn't go anywhere, because if people are going to come to the point where they're actually going to talk about their abortion, you don't, if you think you're not sorry, you're trying to repress and to hide, even from yourself, the pain of your abortion. You start talking about it, it's more likely you're going to be talking about how painful it is. And it would be very difficult to find women in the Silent No More Awareness campaign who did not at one point in their journey say, oh, my abortion didn't hurt me. As time goes on, you follow their trajectory, they realize that so many of the difficulties in their lives are precisely because of that wrong turn called abortion. Proclaiming the healing, sharing the testimonies, and then what does that lead to? It leads to something Pope John Paul II wrote in that beautiful document, The Gospel of Life. He said, those of you who have been healed from abortion become among the most eloquent spokespersons for everyone's right to life. And then people, including those who have been healed, come into the movement and begin doing the large variety of things that need to be done. The things that need to be done, and they need people calling them to do it, and this leads to the question, where is the rallying point for the pro-life movement? Where and how do we most quickly reach the people who are most likely to respond to the call to do something for the children, for the moms and dads? Brothers and sisters, we go back to Dr. Nathanson for the answer. Because one of the things he also said, when he related, after his conversion, the many things that he and his colleagues did to make abortion legal, the statistics that they made up out of thin air about how many women die from illegal abortion every year, statistics the other side still quotes, even though Dr. Nathanson's admission that they made them up out of thin air has been out there for decades, they still use them. And he talks about how they did this so brazenly, so arrogantly. He said, we were taking a big risk. The risk they were taking was not because they didn't think they could get the government on their side. The risk they were taking was not because they didn't think they could get the media on their side. The media was eating up what they were telling them. It wasn't because they didn't think they could get the world of academia on their side. They took a risk, a calculated risk. They knew it was a big risk. And the risk was that the church would not object, would not rise up and say, stop, would not rise up and say, you're lying, would not rise up in a united way and say, this will not happen. Dr. Nathanson and his colleagues knew that the biggest obstacle in their way was the Church of Jesus Christ in all its denominations. He spoke to us clergy after he became pro-life. I was at one of the many talks he gave before he became a Catholic. He was speaking to priests and other pastors. You know what he said to us after he detailed the whole history of what he and his friends did? We would never have gotten away with what we did.
These are his exact words.
We would have never gotten away with what we did if you had been united, purposeful, and strong. He said, we stole the issue from the church. Church was asleep, he said. Asleep. In the later years of his life, he became a bioethicist, by the way. He got a degree in bioethics because he said, I don't want this to happen again. I don't want the church to be caught asleep again. We have to get ahead of the curve. We have to be on top of these issues. Bioethics and genetic engineering and stem cells and all these different things. And so we at Priests for Life are convinced. I know you're convinced that all pro-life people know across the country the need for their clergy to be involved. We're convinced that the architects of the culture of death will still not get away with what they're doing and want to do if we become more united, purposeful, and strong. The clergy, the laity, the churches. You have in the churches the natural constituency for the unborn child. That's where the people are gathering. Most likely to receive the message. Most ready to act on the message. They must be mobilized in and through the churches. Where did the civil rights movement gather? From where did those peaceful gatherings of people so spiritually strong and renewed that they could face dogs and water hoses and deranged, immoral law enforcement officers who wanted segregation more than human dignity? How did they do it? From where did they emerge? They didn't just appear out of nowhere. They gathered in their churches. They were spiritually renewed first. And that's why what we need to do together is to present to our fellow believers, to ourselves above all, and then to the rest of the culture, that pro-life is not just an ideology. It's not just a political platform or a philosophy. It's not just a cause or a movement. What is it ultimately? Brothers and sisters, it's a spirituality. It's an aspect. Why are we doing this? Love your neighbor as yourself. What can be more basic and simple? What can be more comprehensive? We're doing this because we're following a God who says, love your neighbor as yourself. And these are our neighbors. So it's a spirituality. And in the spirituality of this, we don't only find the why. We find the how. The virtues, the characteristics of our spirit that shape our activity flow from the Gospels of Jesus Christ. The courage we need to have. Read the Acts of the Apostles. There's the pro-life movement. The courage. The readiness for public witness. Paul, when he was creating riots in Ephesus and elsewhere, and then the riots were breaking out, where did he want to go? He wanted to go down in the middle of those people. They had to pull him away. The readiness to run. There's a Christian song that says, go towards the roar. You hear the lion roaring in the distance. You know there's a battle stirring. And the human nature wants to run away from the roar. No, we go towards it. That's a virtue. That's a part of the spirituality. The compassion. The love equally for that child and for the mother and the father who are wounded. The love even for the abortionist. The things I've been saying to you tonight. It all gets summed up in a spirituality of being pro-life. And when we present it like this, then people have more of a foundation to persevere in this movement and in this cause. To persevere. And not to go astray into activities that are unfruitful, unwise, or even destructive. And it's something that will lead us to the kind of courage that we need in the pulpit and that we need in our own personal lives. The kind of courage, for example, when election time rolls around. Coming to the end of my time, unfortunately. But when election time rolls around, and I say to the priests when we do our seminars, I say, look,
we get into the pulpit. We're not there to endorse candidates. We don't have to. People are who are listening. And again, it's the churches where you find the natural constituency for the unborn, the people most ready to listen, because they're going to get the message when we stand up there and say certain basic things. We don't have to be endorsing anybody. We get up there and say things like this. If a politician can't respect the life of a little baby, how's he going to respect yours? Or how about this one? I tell the priests to say this in the pulpit. We need public servants who can tell the difference between serving the public and killing the public. And if a public servant can't tell the difference, then he doesn't belong in public office. Now, some people say to me, Father Frank, you're supporting Republican candidates. I said, well, what are you talking about? I didn't say anything about a party. I didn't say anything about a candidate. I'm talking about a moral principle. I said, whether this helps or hurts a particular party or candidate isn't my fault, it's theirs. So the position they take. And here's the litmus test. If tomorrow the parties swapped positions on abortion, if tomorrow in any particular race the candidates swapped positions on abortion, what about our message would change? What word, what sentence, what paragraph of my message would change? What would I have to say differently than we want public servants who can tell the difference between serving the public and killing the public? What changes when I say the fundamental purpose of government is the protection of life? What changes when I say that when we go into the voting booth, we don't cease being Christians when we enter that voting booth? What changes? Nothing changes, because brothers and sisters, there's nothing wrong with political loyalties. We ought to be active in the parties, in the caucuses, in the local level, all the way up to the highest levels of government. We need to be active and informed and loyal where we should be loyal. And we should get involved in the campaigns, and we should support the candidates. But brothers and sisters, when we come to this question of political responsibility, we as believers absolutely have to insist that we're not going to be treated as second-class citizens. We have just as much of a clear right to advance the principles that we're talking about through smart, effective political action as do any non-believers or groups that uphold opposing principles. And it is the church that is called to be not a political party, but an agent of change, putting into practice what the Lord himself said. Go and teach them to carry out, not just to believe, but to carry out everything that I have commanded you. Brothers and sisters, in short, the days of abortion are numbered because people are rising to this challenge. The abortion industry is collapsing. The truth is coming out. And the people of God are rooted in grace and a spirituality that is not going to disappear. We go from strength to strength. The days of abortion are numbered because ultimately, we're not just working for victory, we are working from victory. Is not victory our starting point? Don't we begin by coming together as a church and declaring across denominational lines with all the vigor and faith in our hearts that Christ has died, Christ is risen, Christ will come again. He's alive. And if he's alive,
That means that the kingdom of death, and therefore the kingdom of abortion, has already been overturned. We're in the business of standing up before this society and saying, no, we're not scratching our heads, wondering, how are we going to overcome Planned Parenthood? We're not wondering to one another, how are we going to overcome the abortion industry? How are we going to overcome these mega multi-billion dollar efforts of the other side? We're not wondering that. We don't have to ask that question. No, we are standing before the culture of death, brothers and sisters, and we are saying to it with utter confidence, with our heads high, we are saying, your kingdom has already been defeated. You are already overcome. You have no more authority, no more power to oppress the human family and to destroy our brothers and sisters. We are standing in victory in Jesus Christ because he's already risen and he is coming back. He's coming back soon. Now, we don't know what soon means. We might not have to worry about the elections of 2012. We don't know how soon is. But one thing's for sure, it's going to be a whole lot sooner than a lot of people think. And when he comes back, he will look first and foremost for those who remember his words. What you did to the least of these, you did to me, and he will take us into that everlasting life. The same gift that you and I are so committed to proclaiming day by day. Life. Because he is life, and he has already given us the victory of life. God bless you.
You know, I've been talking to him about his enthusiasm. If he was only just more enthusiastic for the pro-life movement, it would be a lot better. And this is why Father Frank is just so incredible to work with, and he was our spiritual director on our program, and having him in the studio with us was such a blessing. And he was the one who helped us coordinate the ideas and really bring a whole pro-life message to the program that we did. And I just can't thank him enough for his spiritual direction with me and with my work in Catholic Radio. And he's a dear friend and a brother in the Lord. And again, I just can't even, I don't know what to say except thank you for everything that you do. For those of you who haven't, I know some new folks are arriving tonight. I'm Teresa Tomeo from EWTN and Catholic Radio, and I'm your MC for the weekend. I'm also speaking tomorrow on the media, and I know that we are against cloning. However, if I could clone anyone or if I could get someone to get the gift of bilocation, it would be Father Frank Pavone. If he's around tomorrow, I'm actually going to bring him into my media session where I'm talking about media training and helping you get your pro-life message out not only to the Christian media but to the secular media, because that's my area of expertise, and he is just such a great example of really the new evangelization of what our late Holy Father John Paul II talked about. We do have time for Q&A, and so what we're going to do is, if you have a question for Father Frank, what we need you to do, because this is being recorded, is we need you to wait until the microphone comes to you. So if you just stand up and raise your hand, if you're products of Catholic school, you should know how to do that very well, and then they will come over to you with the microphone, then you can ask your question. Capiche? Okay. I don't know if I said this or not, but I'm Italian-American also. I'm just saying. I'm just putting it out. All right. Our first question, if you'd like to stand and state your name and where you're from.
My name is Tom Kurtz. I'm right here in Independence, Ohio, belong to St. Michael Parish. See you at 10 o'clock.
Everybody say hi, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you. Hi, Father. Patrick, where are you? Oh, he walked out. Sorry. Father Pavone, here's my question, two-part. From a legislative point of view, the defunding of Planned Parenthood, will it happen, yes or no? And the second question is your take on the 40 Days for Life movement. Thank you.
Well, the defunding will happen. The timing, I'm not so sure if we need another election to do this. We probably do, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't work as if it's much easier than it may be, because the evil of Planned Parenthood is becoming more and more clear. The more American people know both about Planned Parenthood and about the status of abortion law in our country, the more uncomfortable they become. And they're certainly uncomfortable funding it. We've seen that by polling all along. So yes, it will happen. Maybe after the 2012 elections, when we have a stronger pro-life presence in the Senate, it will be much more doable. And of course a pro-life president, which Ohio is going to help us to get. You see how nonpartisan I'm being. Now, in the 40 days, you know, we have had, I personally and we at Priests for Life, from the time that it was just being done in one or two cities, got very much behind it and told those who were organizing it that that this would spread for a very simple reason. Really, when you think about it, praying, going in front of the abortion mills, this is something that the pro-life movement has done all along, and we have always known. When you do it, things happen. When you go there, lives are saved. When you go there, clinic workers are converted. What is happening here is that it is a very effective way of packaging, marketing, and training people in what is already the basics of the pro-life movement. So I know many of you here are involved, and I thank you for being involved in that.
Good evening, Father. My name is Vicki Fallon. This table is our Southwest Right to Life chapter from the
Great.
Southwest suburbs.
Wonderful.
My question actually comes from a non-Catholic, a friend of mine and others, who've observed what went on during the Obama health care debate, when many, unfortunately, often women in religious orders, aggressively promoted the Obama health care agenda, and they were in positions of power to be very instrumental in getting it passed, even though they knew that it was running contrary to the church and even though the Catholic bishops had asked them not to do this. The question that they, as outsiders, looking at Catholics, and it's interesting how much they do watch what we do, they want to know, where is the church discipline? Why are these people permitted to hold positions of power and influence when they are so contrary to the church leadership and so blatant in those efforts? Can you answer that, please?
Well, and many of our friends in other denominations ask that question, and many church-going Catholics ask the same question. We have a style of leadership today which emphasizes much more the effort of persuasion and dialogue with no less commitment to the truth of our positions. But that's the style of leadership that we have today worldwide. And it is not without merit that we always start with an effort to persuade, an effort to dialogue. But there comes a point where when persuasion and dialogue do not work and scandal grows, that you need discipline imposed in one way, shape, or form. What I say to people both inside and outside the Catholic faith is that we are moving back in that direction. And we saw this already with the many individual statements of bishops in various dioceses over recent years, when they have, you know, gotten, and in some cases have, named people by name, whether it's a church position or a public official, and said what you're doing is inconsistent with church teaching, and I think we'll see more of that. Another distinction to make, however, is this, that the church officials are much more likely to impose discipline when it is a clear up and down matter of doctrine or morals versus situations that they look at as prudential judgments. So, for instance, with the health care debate. We know in our movement what our primary objections are. It's not that we don't want people to have health care coverage. It's that we don't want, first of all, the expansion of abortion and the funding of it, and we want protections of conscience. But because there are, if it were an up and down vote on abortion as such, you would see much more discipline being exercised. But because many of those in leadership are saying, well, this is a matter of prudential judgment, so we're not going to use our teaching authority to say that you should be for or against a specific piece of legislation, especially when it's so complex. Even though the underlying moral issue is clear, the legislation is talking about a whole lot of other things, and especially when the bishops have been so, rightly so, supportive of authentic reform in healthcare and protecting people in our country who don't get services that they need. That's what introduced the level of complication that led to that leads to that question all the time.
Father, you know who I am, so I won't.
Yes, Brian.
you recently wrote what I felt was one of the most important articles you've ever written. And I just was wondering if maybe you give a quick exhortation from that article about the importance of youth in the pro-life movement.
The youth in the pro-life movement.
I love that article you just wrote, and I just thank you for that. So.
Well, this is Brian Kemper of Stand True Ministries, a national ministry for youth in the pro-life movement, and I've long supported Brian's efforts and what he's referring to. And by the way, if you want to get my columns regularly, just go to priestforlife.org. You can sign up for them. Well, I wrote a column that said, you know, what happens when we invite youth to be involved in the pro-life movement? Well, it's something we all want to see. And they're not just future leaders, they are leaders today. And I said, but you know what? When we invite youth to get involved, and they do get involved, they challenge us who are older and have been in the movement longer. They challenge us because they think in straight lines. What I mean is, they'll come in and say, well, okay, you mean to tell me abortions are taking place in that building down there? Babies are being killed? Well, then, what are we doing here? Well, let's go there and stop it. You mean to tell me that candidate for president is in favor of killing babies? Well, then, tell everybody not to vote for him. You see what I'm saying? Then they end up challenging us, who, over the years, have gotten a lot of experience and a lot of wisdom, and we have become rather complex in our thinking, you know? Now, young people, it doesn't mean that young people don't need to listen to those voices of wisdom and experience. They need not only to listen, but to learn from those voices. But at the same time, those voices need to let the young remind us of maybe some things we've forgotten and reignite in us some fire that maybe can go a little straighter once in a while to the goal we need to get to. So thanks, Brian, for reminding me of that.
My question is, if someone is going to protest in front of an abortion clinic or somewhere like that, and he wants to make a sign, and he only has a little bit of space, and people only have a little bit of time to read it, what do you think is the most helpful thing to put on the sign, text-wise?
Text-wise. Okay. Probably something like, we are on your side. We are with you. Come to us. We care. Because remember, their perception is that you're against them. The perception is, and not only their perception, but, well, what they get both from the media and also from the abortion clinic, which, when they make the appointment, will likely tell them, you know, those people are out there to harass you, to hurt you, don't pay any attention to them. They hate you. A message that leaves the door open to them coming to you, not only at that moment, but also later on, text-wise. Now, of course, overall, I would say show the picture of what an abortion is. There is nothing that more powerfully
breaks through a person's denial than when you show them what an abortion is. And this is consistent with the principles of social reform that have led other movements, such as that against slavery, against child labor abuses, and other things, to success. You visualize the victim. The other sign, brothers and sisters, is simply you. By being there, just being there at the abortion mills, and I'm not saying you shouldn't hold signs, but you're the sign too. Do you know how many people, when they get up on the morning of their abortion, say, Lord, if you don't want me to do this, send somebody to tell me to stop? And do you know how many people, I mean, we can count, to a certain extent, we can count those who turn away on that day, who show up at the mill and then they leave. But we cannot count the number of people who drive to an abortion facility because they have an appointment there, see a bunch of people standing outside the door, and don't even stop their car. You ever think about them? We don't know how many there are. They don't even stop their car. You're the sign. You're the answer to that prayer. And they don't want to be going into that. First of all, they don't want to be going to that facility, period. They certainly don't want to go into that facility with an audience of 20 or 100 people. I'll close with this thought. At an abortion mill in Florida one day, there was a lunatic, pro-abort, raging and ranting and ranting and raging the whole time we were there praying the rosary. And he was cursing. He was, I didn't know how his voice sustained all that morning. And then when it came time for us to leave, the guy's name was Carl, well-known pro-abort in the Orlando area. When the time of our prayer came to an end, I huddled the people around me, and Carl finally shut up. He came over to listen to what I was going to say to the people. So when I saw that I had his attention, I said out loud in front of everybody, I said, Carl, I want to thank you for being here today. And I'll tell you why I want to thank you. I appreciate you being here today. Because you made this a very unattractive place to come. I said, after all, what woman in distress, what woman looking for a procedure that she thinks is going to help her is going to want to walk by a raving lunatic? Carl, you've done us a favor. You've saved lives here today. And as a matter of fact, I want to invite you to come to all the abortion clinics where I go across the country. Come with me, please. Brothers and sisters, we have to be signs of Christ. We want to be kind and gentle people. But if you've got, whether pro-abort or pro-life, people acting like lunatics in front of those clinics, don't stop them. Let them be. Do what the Lord has called you to do. But let them be. Because if they make that an unpleasant place to be, fewer people are going to be there. God bless you.